This is the first day of this December 2008 four-day Sesshin. And we will read from a book called Zibo, the last great Zen master of China. And this is translated by J.C. Cleary with a foreword by his brother Thomas. Zibo lived in the 16th century, and we haven't read from him many times in Taisho, maybe only once or twice. 16th century was the Ming Dynasty. He was a leader of the general revival of Buddhism that took place in that period, and one of the last of the traditional Zen men in China who played a prominent role in high culture. He was born in 1544, when Zen was already 1,000 years old in China. By the time he was 4 years old, Zibo still did not talk. At that time, there was a strange monk who passed by his family home. The monk rubbed the boy's head and said to Zibo's father, "When this lad leaves home, he will become a great Buddhist teacher." As he finished speaking, the monk disappeared. After this happened, Zibo was able to speak. You know, with these biographies of the ancient Zen masters, the reader is always in a bit of a delicate position where we can presume that most of what is recorded is true, or at least much of what was recorded is true, but we can never be sure. The Chinese have a tendency, and maybe the Japanese too, maybe human beings have a tendency to embellish biographical accounts. And the Chinese in particular seem to put stock in superstitious events and interpretations of things. So with that caveat, I'll just read it as it's presented here, and my assumption is that it is largely, in its outline, in its broad strokes, it's largely true. But here's an example. So after this happened, Zibo was able to speak. Before this, the footprints of a giant had been seen in the family courtyard, but after this, they were seen no more. As a youth, by the way, these are the words of Hanshan. And a later Zen master who was in the biographical part of the book here. Hanshan is described as a great contemporary and peer of Zibo, and a Zen master in his own right. And he provides this biography of Zibo. As a youth, Zibo was by nature brave and fierce, hardy and energetic. He was unusually big. Even as a boy, he was not fond of play. As he grew up, his resolve increased day by day. His parents could not hold him back from his aspiration for transcendence. aspiration to enlightenment, let's say. Hanshan's record adds that as a young man, Zibo admired the Yu Xia, who were traditional figures in Chinese stories, indomitable freelance fighters who wander the land, righting wrongs, helping the defenseless, and intervening to see that justice was done. Superman, Batman. When he was 17, Zibo took up his staff and sword and left home to travel. Sword, that's a new one. When he had gone as far as the gate of Suzhou City, there was a severe rainstorm and he couldn't proceed any further. He happened to meet a monk named Ming Jue from Tiger Hill Temple. As they looked at each other, Ming Jue saw how strong Zibo looked and knew that even though he was young, he was no ordinary person. So Ming Jue covered Zibo with his umbrella and they returned together to the temple nearby. This is doesn't sound significant in itself, but we'll hear more of the friendship of these two as the account goes on. Some miscellaneous anecdotes here. The translator says, even as a young man of 17, Zibo could move people with his dedication. And then he offers this story. Around this time, Ming Jue needed 10,000 pounds of iron to make a great bell. Zibo said, "I will help." So Zibo went about 30 miles south and sat cross-legged outside the gate of one of the great houses, we would say one of the mansions, one of the wealthiest families. When the owner of the house saw Zibo, he presented him with food. That would be the custom when you see a monk begging for food. But Zibo would not eat. The owner asked him what he needed. Zibo said, 10,000 pounds of iron to make a great bell. If you have it, I will accept your food. The owner immediately had the iron brought forth. Zibo laughed. After he had eaten, he had the iron transported directly back to Tiger Hill. Some more incidents recounted by Hanshan. After returning to Tiger Hill, Zibo stayed behind closed doors and read books. For half a year, he did not cross his threshold. When he saw that some of the monks drank wine and ate meat, Zibo said, "If those who leave home are like this, they should be slain." After that, the monks were very much afraid of him. When he was 20, Zibo received full formal monastic ordination from a monk who specialized in the sutras. There were tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of monks in ancient China at any one time, and they weren't all Zen monks, Chan monks. There were sutra monks who didn't do meditation. And there were other kinds as well. So he was ordained by a sutra monk. He returned to the Suzhou area, which is not far from Shanghai. And one day he said goodbye to Ming Jue and told him, "I must go traveling to the various regions to call on enlightened teachers and clarify the great matter." So he took his staff and departed. Zibo heard a monk reciting a Zen poem that contained the following lines: Cutting off false thought increases the sickness. Going toward true thusness is also wrong. Now let's just look at that statement, because it is not what certainly a it flies in the face of conventional Buddhist teaching. Cutting off false thought increases the sickness. Going toward true thusness is also wrong. First of all, words can be interpreted in different ways. Semantics always can be played with as far as meaning. But beyond that, it's the job of a Zen teacher to help the student get rid of fixed concepts about anything, anything including Zen. So I could imagine a teacher writing these words just as a way to pry the student, dislodge from the student's mind these fixed notions about this and that. And this is, we see this in koans all the time, where it seems to be upside down what is said. The whole point is not to be attached to the words, but to see beyond them. But we'll remember that Zibo had been ordained by a sutra monk, and there's no evidence that he, up to here, there was no evidence that he had any Zen training. So Zibo said to the monk, "That's wrong. It should say, only in cutting off false thought is there no sickness. Going toward true thusness is not wrong." The monk said, "It's you who are wrong, not the author of the poem." Zibo was in a great doubt over this. Wherever he went, he would write the two lines on the wall. His doubt was so intense that his head and face became swollen. One day, at a vegetarian feast, still fixated on the verse, he was suddenly enlightened. The swelling of his head and face at once dissipated. From then on, he was riding high. He said, "If I were with Linji or Deshan, I would have awakened at a single slap. No need to ask how or what." Now, there's a lot in this paragraph, so let's break it down. So he had come to this, the words that he heard from the monk confounded him. It was contrary to everything he had learned. That's the whole point. In Zen, we don't just learn, we want to unlearn. And so he went into this state of intense perplexity. Now appreciate that the only reason he went into such a state of doubt or perplexity was because he had faith that the words were not wrong. If when the monk said, "No, you're wrong, not the author of the poem," and he thought to himself, "No, I don't buy that," then there'd be no doubt, there'd be no perplexity in his mind. It's because he believed the monk, and he accepted his own lack of understanding, that he arrived at such a state of questioning. So doubt is just, doubt and faith are just two sides of one coin. In order to have doubt arise, there must be faith. Faith in something that doesn't add up rationally. So the classic example of this is faith that all beings in their true nature are endowed with this enlightened mind. Okay, there's the faith, and then we regard the condition of the world. We see what humanity is like, and we look into our own mind and we see all of our own defilements, and from that we have a conflict. Something doesn't add up, and that's what gives rise to the doubt or questioning. And it it expressed itself in this physical way, where his head and face became swollen. When one reaches such a state of perplexity, then it's not a matter of holding on to the question or the koan, or letting it go. The koan has a grip on oneself. You're stuck with it. It just gnaws at you and torments you. And this is how it was for Zeebo. We don't know any details. We don't know how long he was in this state. But while at this feast, he suddenly came to enlightenment. And the swelling of his head and face at once dissipated. We read this in some other accounts of the masters after their enlightenment. There's one of another Chinese master who had a severe boil in his back that was terribly large and painful, and after his awakening it just disappeared. And then we see the aftermath of the awakening, where we see conceit, what is sometimes referred in Zen to as the stink of Kensho. Or he says, if I were with Linchi or Deshan, these are two of the most famous names in Tang Dynasty China, Zen, Rinzai and Toksan, that were their Japanese names, I would have awakened at a single slap. No need to ask how. So this kind of swagger that doesn't, again, talk about a contradiction. Awakening reveals the illusory nature of the self. How can you have conceit after awakening? But there it is. It sometimes happens. And that's one of the great benefits of working on subsequent koans, koans after one's first koan, is that the work on these koans, the struggle and the difficulty of them, has a way of scouring away that conceit that can temporarily follow the opening, the kensho. The text goes on. After this breakthrough, Zeebo went to Mount Lu, a Buddhist center, and plumbed the depths of Yogacharya Buddhist philosophy, which was a cornerstone of the Zen school's methods. And just for those of you who might have any interest in this, Yogacharya, the Yogacharya school, which is associated with Zen, the Yogacharya school is sometimes supposed to be a kind of Buddhist subjective idealism. People sometimes say, oh, Yogacharya philosophy means that there is no outer world. But a correct understanding of it is that ordinary people do not perceive the outer world as it is, but perceive it instead, perceive the representations they project upon it due to their conditioning. That's what Yogacharya, or mind only, means. Zebo traveled to Mount Wutai, which is considered one of the four holy mountains of China, and was said to be the abode of Manjusri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He came to a cave on a steep cliff where there was an old monk sitting alone. Zebo bowed to him and asked, "How is it before a single thought is born?" The monk held up one finger. "How is it after it is born?" The monk extended both hands. So these are the two sides of our true nature, of course. Before a single thought arises, before a single word is expressed, before anything, before consciousness moves itself, there's just this one. And then afterward, with the arising of thoughts and consciousness, words, and distinctions, this is the other side of reality, the world of differentiation or multiplicity. And then Zebo met a well-known Zen teacher by the name of Bianrong. And this is how the account goes. When Zebo got to the capital, he called on the great elder Bianrong. Bianrong asked him where he had come from. Zebo said, "From south of the river." Bianrong asked him why he had come. Zebo said, "To study the Buddhist sutras." Bianrong asked, "Why study the sutras?" Zebo said, "To master the meaning of the sutras and propagate them and teach on behalf of Buddha." Bianrong said, "You must be pure and clean to preach the Dharma." Zebo said, "Right now I am not stained by even an atom of dust." This may have been still fresh out of his awakening experience. Bianrong ordered him to take off his kesa and give it to a monk standing nearby. As Zebo took it off, Bianrong said to him, "After you have stripped off one layer, there's still another layer." At that, Zebo laughed and nodded in agreement. And he stayed on with Bianrong. "After you have stripped off one layer, there's still another layer." Says here that he called on all the great elders of the time, Dharma masters, and after 9 years away from home, he returned to Tiger Hill to inform his friend Ming Jue of what he'd been up to. And then he went to a nearby city and spent 100 days behind closed doors. And then he found himself wending his way into cultured high society circles. I won't go into any details because there's just too much here. I want to be done with this in this one teisho, so I'll just go on here. And then in his early 30s, Zebo encountered a monk who would be his Dharma heir, Dao Kai. then there's a description here of this is a different, not Hansham, but a different biographer, a monk, who describes Zibo in this way. The teacher was very large and unusually robust. He was awe-inspiring and seemed ever youthful and unsullied. His flesh was like iron. When lay disciples entered his room, the Doksan room, he stimulated their development in terms of integrity and righteousness and warned them against greed and violence. The teacher's heart was compassionate, but his external appearance was awesome. Among his followers, there were many powerful people and educated gentlemen of means, and he treated them all with equanimity. He always said, "Those who seek the Dharma with worldly sentiments do not enter my room." And then here's another portrait by a different monk. He looked like Maitreya. His mind was like a cold pool. His voice was like a sounding bell. His eloquence like a waterfall. Through his tranquil wisdom and mystic light, his fame spread all over the country. When he was introduced to those of high status who were haughty, he often broke etiquette to humble them. On the inside, he was very compassionate, but on the outside, he was stern and disciplined. He made no distinctions among people as to high and low, or important and unimportant. He treated them all with an attitude of even sameness. Thus, the lowly and the small people took delight in his countenance, and the noble and great viewed him as arrogant. Those who found his gate and entered it invariably took refuge with him. Lots of little things here that we don't have time to read. He became very active in the printing and distribution of Buddhist books. And these efforts came at a time when distorted imitations of Buddhism had sprung up on all sides, and the original message had to be restated. So he made it his task to propagate the Dharma and to aid living beings. He thought about how heavy and numerous the scrolls of the Buddhist canon were. And this meant that the copies were expensive and not very portable. And there were people in out-of-the-way places who had never heard the Dharma. So he wanted to get the Buddhist teachings to people in printed in book form, so that it would be easier to circulate. He promoted this project through his contacts in the official class, and the official class, rather, a government official, the class of government officials, which is the kind of the aristocracy. He solicited the help of wealthy gentlemen, and he ordered Dao Kai, that was his Dharma heir, to coordinate things. And it was this project didn't come to an end until fruition, until after Zibo had died. And the translator here, J.C. Cleary, suggests that Hanshan seemed to want to remind people of Zibo's high standing in society, because in the end he was executed by the emperor, or rather by other. We'll find out that in a minute. Near his hometown, Zebo copied out the Lotus Sutra to repay his debt to his parents. Over the years, Zebo covered the length and breadth of China in his travels, visiting the ancient sites in the Buddhist geography of China, stirring up local support to rebuild temples, teaching by example, persisting in his efforts to bring Buddhism to life. He was once walking along with several others when they came to a stream in full flood. Everyone decided that it was surely impossible to cross. Zebo took off his robe and waded in ahead, calling to the others. The water was up to his shoulders, but Zebo kept plunging ahead. When he got across, he looked back and said to his disciples, "At the gate of birth and death, cross directly to succeed." They may have been more likely to do the same thing if they had been as tall and big as he was. And then Hanshan, the author of most of this, went afoul of the royal court, and without going into all of the twists and turns of this sorry story, he was arrested and tortured. He was stripped of his monk's robes and exiled. And the temple that the Empress Dowager had built for him in the capital was ordered destroyed. These were perilous times when political winds shifted without much warning. And then Zebo's own troubles with the state began in the year 1600, 5 years after Hanshan had gone into exile. There was a new tax that was imposed called the Mines Tax, which had provoked intense resistance, and the eunuch commissioners were sent out to enforce the new tax. So Zebo traveled to the capital to visit an imprisoned governor. He gave the governor a verse and ordered him to recite it 100,000 times. And then Zebo went to bat for Hanshan. He said, again, Hanshan is in exile, "The Dharma gate has no one. If I sit by and watch while the banner of the Dharma is pulled down, then I am not applying my mind to perpetuate the three jewels and to make them flourish. If old Hanshan does not return from exile, it will be a great wrong and a great defeat for my appearing in the world as a Buddhist teacher. If I can wipe away these wrongs, I will never again go to the imperial capital." So Zebo protested these government actions, putting himself in great danger. The Ming Dynasty state was notorious for its harsh treatment of critics, even when they held official rank. For a monk to venture political criticism was extremely risky. His disciples begged him to stop his protests. His assistant, Dao Kai, wrote to him in blood, pleading with him to go into hiding. But Zibo replied, "When I cut off my hair to become a monk, it was already like cutting off my head. What other head do I have that can be cut off?" So he persisted. And although he was slandered in more than one memorial to the throne, Zibo was aloof and unconcerned. And then some letters he had written came to light. They were portrayed as seditious. And those who were jealous of him took the occasion to denounce Zibo. And in the end, because of this, he met with disaster. Just to sum up, the translator says that Zibo was guilty of two basic crimes in the eyes of the Ming Dynasty. He publicly objected to government actions like the exile of Han Shan and the new tax, and he was connected to the wrong people in high society. Zibo said somewhere that it was, he said in a letter that it was unfilial on the part of the emperor to go against his mother's compassion. And this was a capital offense. No one could get away with calling the emperor unfilial. So he was taken away under arrest. And as he left, he spoke a verse for the temple monks. "Old man Zibo is leaving the mountain. Relax, you Zen men in the hall. Above your heads there's the sky. Opening the correct eye, we see. In any situation, disaster and blessings all come from past causes." So this is my karma, he would say. In prison, he wrote these verses. The sojourner, meaning he's referring to himself, the monk, the wandering monk, the sojourner dares to insist that he's totally innocent. Recognize that the moment of birth equals the moment of death. See through them, and death and birth are originally one strand. Perhaps Yamaraja, supposed to be the lord of death, who in Buddhist mythology holds up a mirror of karma before us after we die. Perhaps Yama commands the secret police. Fiery cauldrons, icy mountains, is there anything to them or not? Let me ask you what you have understood. Our petty, 6-foot-tall bodies are like reeds. A string of pearls, 108. By chance, one pearl drops off. No need to search outside of things, adding on birth and death. So he was whipped with a bamboo rod. After being whipped, he wrote 30 blows of the bamboo to repay an old debt. Whether a criminal name is light or heavy, what can be done? Pain becomes the universe. Who can recommend it? A laugh in reply. There's the void. As I sit, I feel the pain gnawing into my flesh. being torn limb from limb this year, is there anything to it or not? Bamboo can cause pain, I can tell you. With my buttocks in ribbons, I try to sit cross-legged. And then after he was whipped like that, he died. Before dying, he washed himself, and Zebo told his attendant, "I'm going. Please thank all the protectors of the Dharma back home for me." The attendant began to cry. Zebo scolded him, saying, 20 years with me, and you still behave like this?" Then Zebo spoke several verses for the man, and when he finished, peacefully passed away, sitting upright. And then there's a lot of this. There's a eulogy, Hanshan's eulogy of Zebo, which we'll skip now. And our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.